Hey, saucy but sweet fam. Today, we about to go in. We're not going to be throwing too much shade, but just enough. I'm just kidding. But really, we are going to dive into some important conversations about the struggles of being a Black storyteller in journalism and photography. As a Black journalist, I've heard a lot of no's, but at the same time, I feel like I'm heading somewhere great. Getting my master's at what I consider one of the best journalism schools in the country has really brought up my confidence. When one of my personal essays I published at the HuffPost, titled Why I Dated a Guy Who Fetishized Me for Being a Black Woman, was republished on Huffington Post UK, I felt like I had the world in my hands. But being a freelance journalist is tough. There are many rejections and tons of times where finding a job seems endless. I really do feel like I'm back on track, and I thank the Craig Newmark School of Journalism, also known as the J School, for that. I was recently given the opportunity to intern at one of the top newspapers in the country. Now, although I'm very lucky and privileged to be able to say this, there are many who are still struggling to make ends meet and are overlooked in the media. Now let's unpack that. Stick with us. You are now listening to Saucy But Sweet with Ally McPherson, a podcast where nothing is off limits, where we talk about everything from romance, sex, pop culture, and everything in between. Sit back, relax, and enjoy an unfiltered time where we keep it sweet and always saucy. This week, we are joined by George Romero, who is the co-producer of Saucy But Sweet with Ally McPherson and the graphic designer for our posts on these internets. And later, we have Aaron Foley, who recently took the position as Black Media Initiative Director at Newmark Graduate School of Journalism's Center for Community Media. I'm so happy to have them on.
Welcome to Saucy But Sweet with Ally McPherson from, you know, the hosting chair. Yeah, and so I know you're usually behind the scenes. Can you introduce yourself for those who don't know you?
Hello, everyone. From behind the scenes, my name is George Romero. I am a graduate student / freelance journalist. I go to the new school. I study media studies. I help Ally out with this podcast, mostly Afro-Latino photographer, and I do a lot of cool creative stuff. So, yeah. What's up, everybody?
Awesome. Dope. Yeah, and you do great graphic on the internets for me, so. So the first question I have, so as you know, we're talking about, you know, Black storytellers and like the struggle with being underrepresented in photography and journalism. Can you talk a little bit about what it's like being a working Black journalist and photographer right now, especially during the pandemic? Because I know we're all struggling.
All right, I'm going to be honest, it's pretty hard. Like, especially starting as, like, a recent grad, like, yo, this shit is hard. It's kind of, I'm already at a disadvantage. Like, I'm Black, so I'm also overlooked a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm not much of a writer. I usually like to, just make multimedia stories in addition to writing, but, like, I never really just write. It just never was my thing in school. So, you know, I just feel like in the industry, like, a lot of trying to, like, break in as a photographer is a little hard. So that's why I always try to diversify. But, yeah, even though with all this, it's still pretty hard to do it. Mm. So I'll face, like, the full force of it once I, like, really graduate and have nothing else bogging me down.
Yeah, and shout out to the new school. We both went to the new school together, and you're getting your graduate degree from there. So shout out. Woo! I'm in debt because y'all.
figuratively and literally.
But I knew so, like, there's so many talented Black photographers at that school, and people who come out and kill the game.
Oh yeah, there's two of them that I know, like Miles Lofton and Quill Lemons. Like, they're great. I think Quill actually graduated with us. I think Miles graduated like this year actually, but they're incredible.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Guys listening, please go check those two out. They are amazing.
Yeah. And also another thing that kind of bothers me, is that how expensive art schools are and how expensive and mostly white these like elite photography programs are. I feel like it feels very biased. It does. And shout out to ICP at The Point in the Bronx. any people of color, any, like, you know, black people trying to get in, learn photography, film photography, right, in the dark room, stuff like that. They can go to The Point, which I've never been before. I remember I took classes at ICP in Manhattan, and I had a scholarship, and that's why I learned how to use the dark room and stuff like that. But I was lucky enough to get a scholarship, and I didn't have to pay for the camera. So there's always ways for black and Latino people to dig into this. It's just you really have to go out and find it. It's not easy.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, like, a lot of people, like, I'm around, like, they didn't really have, like, a formal art education.
Yeah.
Like, I dig it. I learned, like, off of YouTube, and, you know, I don't brag about my work, but the one time I did take a photography class after doing school, my professor did say that my work was on par with, like, half of, like, the photo majors.
Wow. And you taught yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I taught myself because, you know, I was already, like, 3/4 done with my degree. There was no way I was going to have a photography degree to get and graduate on time.
Wow.
You know, but for the most part, I also learned from my sister.
Mm-hmm.
And while my sister doesn't do photography anymore, like, she was always there to, like, help me and show me things during, like, that very first year I started, like, shooting seriously.
Yeah.
And, you know, it all pretty much went from there, and, yeah, that's how I started.
Yeah, and do you make it your mission to focus on shooting black people and, you know, Latino people? Like, is that something that you do because maybe you don't see that a lot?
Yes. And I'll go on a whole tangent about this. Basically, you know, and I'll admit, I used to be one of these people that most of, like, photography, well, like, most of, like, you know, like, prosumer photography, not, like, real pro-level photography, it's just people, it's, like, mostly men just shooting girls in, like, provocative positions or, in, you know, good clothing. And, you know, there's nothing, I just never really liked it.
Yeah.
Like, people, like, it always made it seem like it was just sort of a cool factor, and I'm just like, no.
Yeah.
Like, I got burnt out of it, like, super quick.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm friends with, like, an ICP instructor, like, an ICP curator, actually. His name is Wesley Verhoeve.
Awesome. And
I went to his studio one day, and, you know, we were having a conversation about this, and he was like, yeah, like, how many, like, portraits of pretty women are cool and all, but, like, how many times can you really do that and still get fulfillment out of it? So, you know, it just, that conversation really resonated with me a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just decided, like, you know, if I'm going to be a photographer, but most importantly, a black photographer and an Afro-Latino photographer, I got to make work that matters. Like, I just don't want to have my work, you know, just fill into, like, the endless sea of, like, portraits of pretty girls. Like, I'm okay with shooting portraits, but I don't want to just be known for that.
Yeah.
Like, I want to make work that, you know, resonates with people and helps tell stories of people that don't get the spotlight all the time. Like, I remember, like, last year I made a series on Dominican women and their relationship with hair, and that was, like, the first time that I actually felt like I photographed with a purpose, and
loved it. Yeah, and what was that? How did that concept come to you?
I'm not gonna hold you. I just randomly thought about it.
Yeah. No, sometimes things are random, and they could become your best things. Yeah.
it's just one of my very good friends at the time. I'm still friends with her, but yeah, one of my good friends at the time. She was a Dominican woman, and we got really close. And I was talking to her, like, you know, I want to branch out and do something, like, that will make me stand out. And, you know, we had a conversation, and, you know, we always had conversations about hair, and, you know, I brought the concept to her, and she really liked it.
Yeah.
So we brainstormed a little bit, and I also photographed one of my friend's friend, so that's how the project came along. Honestly, I kind of thought about, like, within 2 weeks from, like, not that I thought about it in 2 weeks, but, like, I thought about it one day and actually did it within 2 weeks, so.
Wow. And what was the name of that?
It was called Pelo Bueno, Pelo Malo, which is Spanish for good hair, bad hair. It is about the relationship that Dominican women have with their hair, because in Dominican culture, as problematic as it is these days, there is always one thing that stuck out to me growing up, not just for women, but also for like men as well, especially Black men, is that, you know, there's always kind of like a expectation of how your hair should be. So,
like straighter, like straighter is better.
Like straighter, Euro style.
Of course.
Like, you know, Black hair was not really acceptable.
Yeah.
Like, it was like open discrimination against
horrible.
People who have, yeah, there's open discrimination.
And yet there's so many Black people,
yeah, like,
in that
I'm pretty sure like 90% of DR has some Black blood in them, and they don't want to admit it.
Yeah, and it's sad. And I also shout out to the project you did when we were seniors at the New School, where you kind of dug into like how gentrification is impacting Black and brown people in these communities. And that was really big, because it's everywhere, especially like in New York City. So many areas are gentrified and people are getting pushed out of where they live, and they don't get to benefit from this new area, you know, what these areas, you know, are doing. And yeah, I thought that was a great piece too.
Thanks.
Yeah, you went really in on that one.
Yeah, that one. I worked on for like a straight year before it was actually due.
Yeah, I remember that. You were working on it, and I was like, you working on that already? Dag. I didn't even start my Capstone yet when you were doing it.
Yeah, it's because one of our classmates that graduated a year before us told me to start early, and I was like, bet.
That's why you were helping me so much with mine. That's why you were, really, like that Rooted in West Africa, Blooming in America documentary, which, please guys, go on YouTube, look at it. That's my first documentary. And the thing is, I just want to keep doing these things where I'm shining a light on Black people, you know, because I don't see it enough. If I don't see it enough, I'm gonna keep doing it. You know what I mean? And I love it. I love incorporating our culture.
You know, that's what I wanted to do more as a photographer.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, obviously we're both talented and we know other Black people that are so talented in the photography realm and journalism realm. Why do you think, and this is a question I know you ask all the time, like, why do you think publications are not hiring more people like us to shoot people like us, or to, you know, write stories and cultivate these stories? And why are we being so overlooked in the industry after they know what we can do and we've shown what we can do?
There's a lot of answers to that.
Uh-huh.
But one of the things that I can certainly say about that, that also applies to like having a journalism education or trying to get one.
Yeah.
Is it's more about who you know, the rather than what you can do. So, you know, you kind of have to be in kind of sort of a position of privilege to get ahead,
mm-hmm.
or be like a good early start in the industry, unless, you know, you're really talented. There's a lot of really talented people who often are overlooked just because they don't have connections or don't know where to
mm-hmm.
place their work at.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a story about how Brooklyn Beckham was able to shoot a cover, and it was, the images were like really subpar the last time I seen that. And there was like a lot of talk about, you know, the reason he got the opportunity to shoot the covers because he's David Beckham's son.
That's a fact. And he and his mom is a fashion designer, so he can really shoot anything he wants to. And another thing is, remember when he was at our school for like 5 minutes and everybody was up his ass and acting like he was some saint, and he had a photo book that came out, photography book that came out that same year. And I was thinking to myself, wow, this guy is coming to the school and then dropping out and doing whatever the hell he wants and can still have a career. When you think about those things, it can make you feel like, wow, am I ever going to make it? And you just have to keep that confidence up. Like, I'm dope. I'm not a Beckham, but I don't mean I'm not dope. And also, I wanted to mention, as you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to do this episode was the Simone Biles controversy, you know, where her Vogue, her recent Vogue cover, which at first, to be honest with you, when I saw it, I didn't see anything wrong with it, for like from the naked eye when I was looking at it. But then I saw the criticism, which was very valid. And the cover was photographed by Annie Leibovitz, who everyone knows. And there was a long list of Black photographers that they could have had do this. And there was even a thing on Twitter where I saw a Black photographer edit it in a way that, like, oh, wow, that would have been it would have been edited a lot better if this person did it. And so what do you kind of think about that controversy? Like, how does that make you feel as a Black photographer?
Yeah. You know, first off, they should have got Dana Scruggs to shoot that shit. That was not disrespectful.
Say the name?
They should have got Dana Scruggs to shoot that.
Okay.
Yeah, Dana Scruggs, for people who are listening who don't know, Dana Scruggs is a very great Black woman photographer. Mm-hmm. She has done a lot of firsts. I can't name them off the top of my head right now, but she is, like, one of the best Black photographers ever.
Yeah, and magazines, though, they need to step it up because they have white photographers taking pictures of white celebs and white people, and it's like, well, when we're on the covers, right, because we fought to be on these covers, we don't have people like us shooting us, and we know how to edit ourselves, you know what I mean? And we had to teach ourselves this, and it's like, really need to do better and hiring people so we can see ourselves behind the lens just as much as in front of the lens, you know? And so this controversy, I'm really glad that people did cause a stir with it because it maybe helps Vogue see.
Editorial photography is like a really weird space.
Yeah, and don't get me started about the fashion industry. I used to watch a Victoria's Secret fashion show, for example, and you could count on your fingers the amount of Black models you see walking down a runway. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it's very, very upsetting. So it's not surprising that Vogue did something like this, you know, and I'm glad. And I'm sure, you know, they're going to hear what I heard. I'm sure they heard the controversy and they, you know, things are changing, especially 2020. People are protesting. We're saying no more. We're saying a lot of things that people don't want to hear. And I think that things are going to change for the better. Also, before we go, shout out to Polly Irungu, who is a digital content editor at WNYC and the founder of Black Woman Photographer. Just in case you guys didn't know, hashtag Black and Media Day took place on July 16th, which I participated in as well. And I thought it would be a good way to put, basically it's a good way to put your work on the map as a Black journalist, photographer, podcaster. I actually forgot to do a hashtag Black and Media Day for this podcast. I should have, but I didn't. I actually posted an article that I did in the past. Shout out to Trey Green, who is the founder of Black and Media and hashtag Black and Media Day, for allowing us to take space and feel pride and honor for the work we do, because it's easy to feel unappreciated as a Black creator.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really felt that last part.
Yeah, for real. Like, I want people who are listening to this, I'm sure people who are listening to this are where we are now and who experienced it, or they're doing great and they know what it's like to not do too great. And we're all in this together. We're killing the game. You know what I mean? We killing it. And I know you're going to do great work. You're doing great work with this podcast anyway. And, you know, this is like, for me, like such a, this gives me purpose, this whole podcast.
Yeah. And it's helping find, you know, it's helped me find that I like to do other things too. It's not just photography and videography anymore. Like branching out, I think, even if you're a photographer, like branching out into like other mediums helps you make better work anyways. So yeah.
For real. I'm pretty happy. Pretty happy. And yeah, that's the end of this segment. Next guest is Erin Foley. but yeah, thank you for joining us and being on the other side of this podcast.
Back to your side I go.
Yeah.
Somewhat.
Yeah. Yeah, awesome. Peace.
Our next guest is Erin Foley.
Thank you for coming on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
For those who don't know you, can you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Aaron Poley. I am director of the Black Media Initiative at the Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at CUNY. The Black Media Initiative is very new. I started in June, but the process to start the initiative started back earlier this year in January, December or January, around that time. And basically, it's designed to support, advocate for, bring awareness around Black media outlets. So that includes your legacy newspapers. You know, if you grew up or if you lived in a city with a significant Black population, you may have had a weekly or a daily paper or something along that line that specifically served the Black community, all the way up to your some of your larger outlets. So we're talking like The Griot, The Root, BET, The Undefeated, things like that, and everything in between, with the goal of some places may need more help than others, but with the goal of just advocating that Black journalists working at these Black media outlets are just as important, just as in need of all of the, you know, new things going on in the journalism industry and things like that. These outlets should not be overlooked.
And can you kind of talk about like your journey into journalism, like how you got your start, some of the struggles you have like as a Black journalist? Because for me, getting out of school and just becoming a freelance journalist kind of scares me a little bit, because I want my benefits and I want to have like something very like constant. So if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So my career has honestly been all over the place, and I'm just now starting to embrace that. I feel a lot of that is part of my changing interests, but a lot of that is really just the, the reality of the industry. I finished college at a time when the industry was really starting to change, and then the recession happened like a few years after graduation and stuff like that. So I was really just trying to keep my head above water. My mother was a journalist for a very long time. We're from Detroit, and she worked at a Black newspaper. She worked at the Michigan Chronicle. And back, you know, the staff is a lot smaller now, but back then it was still not a very large staff. She did it all. She was a reporter, she was an editor, copy editor, did almost every department, everybody did that, back then. And it was just, it was truly a labor of love. But my mom was also a single parent. So, if my grandmother wasn't watching me, my mom would have to take me to her work sometimes. And that's when I really got exposed to journalism and seeing the work that she did. I started doing it on my own. So I had a very more typical, like, you know, I did my high school paper, I did my college paper, I did internships at newspapers in college. And I was thinking that, like, you know, newspapers were going to be the way to go. This is like mid-2000s, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you had to get all the internships at the big, like, New York Times and Washington Post and stuff like that. And that's when I first kind of got the inkling around, I was like, oh, I'm doing it big. I'm at my high school paper. I'm at my college paper. I got it, right? And you start to notice that, Black college students working in journalism aren't getting some of those same opportunities, right? Yeah. And it wasn't until I was looking back in hindsight, I was like, oh man, I applied to all these different places. I never really got the chance. So, but you know, you're kind of young and not thinking about that. You're just like thinking about getting a job. So mm-hmm. I got a job at a mid-sized paper. There were layoffs there. I did not get laid off. Then I went on to, but I saw the layoffs coming. So I was just like, I got to get out of here. So then I went to a digital outlet, which I helped start, mm-hmm. with the staff there, the only Black person working there, but it didn't bother me because at the time I was still thinking like, oh, I need a job and stuff like that. And then layoffs were coming there and I was just like, okay, we got to get out of here. Went to an automotive news publication because I was writing business at the old place. And then I was like, well, now I can cover the car business. I'm in Detroit. This is going to be solid because we're the Motor City, and this is a publication that has stood the test of time. I'm getting paid like mm-hmm. where I think I should be at, and I'm like, this is it. And I get laid off from that job. So I was mad, and I ended up freelancing. And freelancing has its pitfalls, certainly, but I really built a niche for myself, really freelancing a lot about Detroit, at a time when there was growing interest in Detroit. So kind of two things were happening at the same time there. I was writing for Reuters, I wrote for CNN, I wrote for The Atlantic, I wrote for, you know, whoever, like, you know, I don't mean to throw out all these big names, but at the same time, I was just like, I got to get a check. I need to, you know, pay these bills. So yeah. Whoever, give me a check, like, but, you know, it was great working with all those editors and whatnot. But eventually I became an editor at one of the places I was freelancing for. And that was a local magazine in Detroit called Black. And that was my first jump truly into Black facing media. I had done a lot where I was either the only Black person or what have you. But now I was just like, okay, I'm with my people, I feel like, you know, and really doing a lot of the stuff that really matters to me from the perspective of a Black person. So I did that for about 2 years. And I had a friend, Alexis Wiley, who used to be a broadcast reporter. And then she ended up becoming the mayor's press secretary.
Wow.
And then ended up becoming the mayor's chief of staff. And she never really lost her passion for media and journalism, even after working for a mayor. And she gave me a call one day and she was like, you know, our media department is really expanding and we need someone to like start a new thing where it's just like you'll almost be like an editor within the media department. You can run this whole thing. And it was attractive to me at the time because at the magazine I worked at, where I was editor, it was a great experience. I loved it. I loved running a magazine. I loved running a Black magazine, but we had two people on staff. It was me and somebody else. And it was just like my mom all over again. It was just like the two of us are doing everything. It was part of a larger company, but still, like, we were the only two full-time dedicated on that masthead, and we shared the rest of the creative staff with the other magazines that were part of that conglomerate. So when Alexis called and she's like, we're going to give you a budget, we're going to give you people to hire. And I was just like, yes, people, like, I can really, really do it now. And that's when I became a chief storyteller for the city of Detroit, made up the job title. And I said, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to make sure that whatever we do is reflective of Detroit and it feels like Detroit. So we started this digital outlet within the city government's media department. I hired an all-Black team, all younger people than me. I'm not that old. But I was also just kind of going back to, like, again, now I'm kind of in hindsight at this point in my career and looking back on all the opportunities I feel like I missed out on because, and I was just like, well, now I have the opportunity to kind of give a boost to some Black creatives who may have been overlooked. And each person I hired said the same thing when I interviewed them. They were just like, I applied here. This place has had me on hold for so long. Mm-hmm. And I had, you know, one of my employees is very relevant to the conversation. She originally wanted to go into broadcast, but she loves changing her hair as many women do. But, you know, she was told by a news director, you know, you can't wear your natural hair.
Wow.
You know,
which now is not legal, right? Now you're not able to.
Yeah, you can't do that now. But this wasn't that long ago. Mm-hmm. This was maybe like 2014, maybe.
Wow.
You know, like
yeah.
So little things like that you would think not happened in Detroit, which is a majority Black city. Mm-hmm. But even then, like now that I've been in all these different places, I've had some time to kind of look at my career as a whole. I realized I was either the only Black person in some spaces, or a lot of the places in Detroit that I applied for and never got into were majority white. And I'm like, but the city is majority Black. And how do you reconcile all of this? So that's kind of put me in this mission, I guess, to kind of, you know, do everything I can to diversify, give opportunities or advance or advocate for Black journalists, whether they work for, you know, Black media is my focus now at CUNY, but whether they working for Black media or not, because now we see in not just Detroit, but several other cities where there's not only a deficit of Black people in newsrooms, but there's also a deficit in Black people in those cities who, you know, the readers, the audiences, not getting the information that they need, not getting the news that they deserve, because there's no one representing that community within the media that's there. Mm-hmm. So I'm taking all of this. This is why I was like, oh man, my career's been kind of crazy. I've been doing this. But now I realize I'm just like, okay, I'm going to take a little bit from everywhere I've gone and everything I'm done, and kind of put all of that into what I'm doing now at CUNY. So
yeah. And you mentioned layoffs. Did you find that it was just like the Black people being laid off first?
No. Yeah, well, it depends on how you look at it. Mm-hmm. So the first two jobs that I worked at, it was they were mostly going after the older people.
Okay.
Right? Because that was the mentality at the time, was like, the older people who are making the bigger salaries, we're going to force them into buyouts and retirement. The job that I ended up getting laid off at, the company had a mentality of, last hired, first fired, pretty much.
Wow.
And I was thinking, like, I was the last one hired.
Okay.
And my editor there, you know, he told me that he fought hard for me. And I completely believe him on mm-hmm. that. I don't doubt him on that. But I was starting to wonder, like, you know, the company as a whole, like, how much diversity did they bring in mm-hmm. right before the layoffs? I don't want to say they, like, set us up for the layoffs. But at the same time, when you look at, you know, legacy companies and companies that don't hire often, and suddenly they have like a diversity push, and they may not be in the financial position long term to sustain that. Well, yeah, you're working to diversify a company, but then when the layoffs come, instead of a strategic way of laying people off, you go with the last hire, first fired way of doing things, and then you lose all of that diversity that you just brought in. So
yeah.
That question kind of lingers, but you know, I can't say definitively where I worked prior to that, or any of the other places where that did have layoffs, like they were specifically targeting Black people. That's not to say it doesn't happen,
yeah.
you know, elsewhere. But
I'm sure it does.
From my
yeah,
yeah,
mm-hmm. yeah. And also something I wanted to bring up is, like, you know, during the pandemic and the protests, we've seen many publications kind of show their true colors. When talking about social unrest, with like publishing insensitive headlines or stories that some Black staff members deemed inappropriate. Like with the Philadelphia Inquirer, I'm not going to talk too bad about, because I'm going to be interning there in January. Some staff members were not coming to work because they were disgusted at the fact that their white staff members were making more money than them, which is obviously a valid criticism. Do you think we're moving in the right direction? Do you kind of see change happening here?
Absolutely. I mean, I will say this now. I am very pessimistic about change, because my view has always been, like, journalism or not, you know, Black folks in this country have been systematically denied for 400 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not going to take a summer of protest to, like, fix all this, right?
Yeah.
But what I do see is, you know, I see an energy with folks coming into newsrooms now that I cannot have done when I was first starting out. Like, when you talk about going to intern at the Philadelphia Tribune, I mean, not the Tribune, that's the Black paper. but there are, you know, my brain is wired to all the Black media now, but the Inquirer, you know, and still having criticism for them. I could never, you know, at when I was going into an internship, you know, all the places I interned, you could not say anything. You know,
and I'm scared now, actually. I hope I don't have to cut this out.
No. I mean, I think now we are empowered to say, like, hey, I'm glad you all are taking this chance on me. I want to give you the best. I hope I can, you know, get that reciprocal. But, you know, let's talk about this.
Yeah.
Let's talk.
Yeah.
You know, I came up in an era where, like, they were just starting to, like, Facebook was new when I was in college. And that was the whole time, and like people were still doing, like, their own blogs and stuff like that. That was the time when the recruiters were, like, looking at your profiles and looking to see if you had, like, red cups, and were you doing, like, keg stands and stuff. Like, I went to a school in the Midwest, so keg stand was the thing to do. But the recruiters were looking to see, like, what you were saying about them and how would you represent the company. And I do know stories of people who were critical of places that they wanted to intern at, and then a recruiter was just like, oh, I saw this on your blog, you know, you can't, forget it. So now that we're in this moment where especially Black journalists and people and journalists of color, period, where these long overdue conversations can be had. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, this is a moment that Black journalists should seize upon, really take their employers or prospective employers to the carpet, take them to task, and say, like, you are, you know, it's not about, let me say this, it's more about serving the audience the news and information that they deserve. And you can't do, you're going to lose a Black audience if you put racist headlines. You're going to lose a Black audience if you don't have Black people in your newsroom talking directly to them. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for long-term sustainability and survival, you need diversity, and it shouldn't even be a question at this point.
Yeah.
So.
No, for sure, and I'm with those people who are saying I need to be getting paid what I'm worth. Now, something else I wanted to bring up, my co-producer, George, who I actually had on for this episode as well, to talk about photography and how we're underrepresented in photography, he brought up something that really upset me about how some of the HuffPost Black Voices articles are written by white reporters. And I was looking through them, and one actually was writing about the protest. And I didn't even kind of want to read it because I was kind of a little disgusted and turned off by the fact that these were not Black authors. And I know there's tons of Black journalists out there that want the chance and that are begging for the chance to work for these positions. And yet you have white reporters, especially in a section called Black Voices. And I kind of wanted to know your thoughts on that. Is that insensitive for them to be doing this, or is it fair game? What do you think about that?
If I remember correctly, and I could be wrong because I'm not in a daily consumer of the Huffington Post, but I think I'm thinking, and this is not excusing it, but I'm thinking that it may be a situation where, like, anything Black is just tagged to that page and it's just kind of shared all over the place. That said, I do think that they are, if that is the case, then they are definitely abusing the brand behind Black Voices. It does make me upset that a lot of Black issues are kind of framed through the lens of a white byline. The way I see us addressing that is calling people out on it, you know, making people realize that there is Black talent and showing people where the opportunities are for people to be hired or at least get some of those freelance bylines. Where I've seen a disconnect is I don't want to call recruiters or editors lazy, but I look back to my time in Detroit and how I was very, very easily able to hire 5 Black creatives in one fell swoop. And I still had editors coming to me from the other publications asking, where do you find Black people? Where do you find Black people? I can't. And I'm like, first of all, we're in Detroit. Like, we're surrounded by Black people. Come on now. But, you know, I think a lot of journalism, that could be from the big papers up to the small ones, are still kind of working off of this old model of, like, if you build it, they will come.
Yeah.
You know, that type of mentality. It's just like, you have to build networks. And you have to build, I don't want to call it a non-traditional network, because that's sort of others, journalists of color, but for lack of a better term, you know, you kind of have to build that non-traditional network.
Yeah, and do you feel like it's also, like, where these recruiters are going? Because I feel like there are HBCUs, there are Black upcoming journalists that you can go to, but it's like, if you choose to go to a mainly white school, of course you're going to find more white people. Like my alma mater is the New School. If you go to the New School, of course you're going to have, like, me and then maybe 4 other Black people, not a lot, but it's not that we're not there. It's just a lot of us can't afford to go to this school. You know what I mean? And you're not putting yourself in spaces where there are lots of Black people.
Yeah, yeah. You know, for so, and that was definitely an issue with, you know, not just like places like the Times and the Post. You know, they're only going to, like, Harvard and Yale and Brown and, you know, all the Ivy League schools. It's things like that where I realized that, you know, again, recruiters, hiring editors are still working on this broken system of name recognition, going for what they consider prestige, and leaving a lot of people out. And again, you miss out on all that Black talent because you're so used to this old system of, I'm just going to go to this one school because they're reliable. They always send somebody out there. Well, these schools are mostly white. There's also a question of intimidation too on the part of students. And I don't blame the students at all, but, like, I've heard multiple times just talking to folks whether they're at the college student age or more the young professional age, where it's just like, I do not want to go to this place and be the only Black person. You know, again, the way I was conditioned, where it's just like, you know, just be happy to get a job, to folks being more conscious about it and saying, like, I don't want to go work for X because I know they're going to other me. I know they're going to token me. And I just would not feel comfortable in this environment. So, again, that's no fault of them, the students or the professionals looking for a job. That's a fault on these newsrooms for creating this atmosphere in these environments where Black people don't feel comfortable. And then they complain and stuff like that. And just like, oh, we can't find any Black people. It's just like, well, if you had Black people in the first place, then this wouldn't be an issue. So mm-hmm. we have a lot of work to do.
And equal pay. It's another one. That's one that I can't believe we're still not on the streets about, you know, equal pay. There's still more people getting higher pay because of they're a man or they're white. And it sickens me because it's like, what? You know, we're all talented. You know, we're all in this space doing good work and you have some people making more. That's enough for another episode. Yeah. But thanks for coming to speak with me. This was a great conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me, like, anytime. And, you know, just want to tell folks, all the students at CUNY, you know, I'm here. You know, let's talk, whatever I can do to help. And definitely, you know, pay attention to, you know, what we're trying to do with the Black Media Initiative, because hopefully we can do something special.
Yeah. Yeah, and welcome to CUNY. I think you're going to do great. As you know, I'm a part of NABJ, and we're happy to work with you. And I hope we get that Black Media Fair. I'm so excited about that. I've been talking about that since I first got on NABJ.
Keep your fingers crossed.
Yes.
No promises yet, but, you know, just keep your fingers crossed. So.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you again, and I'll see you.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
And that's all for this week. Thank you for tuning in to Saucy But Sweet with Allie McPherson.